Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Clinical Associate Professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Florida, Simon Swift. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm sorry that we've had a slightly delayed start, and we're also having some issues with the audio. So if you find there's problems with my voice, you're having difficulty hearing me, what we might do is have to postpone this and do it at another time when we can get hold of better equipment. Anyway, so the plan for the next hour or so is to talk about, to take you through mitral valve disease, which, as you know, some of you will know, is a disease that's dear to my heart, having been closely associated with the Cavalier Club in the United Kingdom for 20 years before I came to Florida. And by the way, it is warm and sunny here, sorry. So when we talk about mitral valve disease, there's actually kind of two forms of acquired disease that we talk about. Obviously, there's congenital mitral valve disease or mitral valve dysplasia, but we're not going to cover that in today's talk. So far as the acquired diseases, we have both degenerative valvular disease, which is your bread and butter as practitioners. It's what you see day in, day out, very, very common. However, infective endocarditis is always lurking on the horizon. It's a particularly unpleasant disease in my experience. It tends to affect mainly large breed dogs. It can affect both the mitral and aortic valves in dogs, although in our large animal species, if any of you do large animal work, it's usually tricuspid or pulmonic valve. Then the typical signs, the typical triad is a pyrexia, lameness, and a new or changed murmur. It's typically the dogs are also ill. They are septicemic effectively, so you'd expect them to be pretty poorly with this disease. Whereas with degenerative valvular disease, they tend to be pretty normal with few other signs in the early stages. Ultimately, they can get vegetations on the valves, and that's the easiest way of diagnosing this with echocardiography. And obviously, a positive blood culture is the definitive method of making a positive diagnosis. But you'll be pleased to know I'm not going to talk a lot about endocarditis other than this one slide. So just to remind you, there are different diseases we do sometimes see, but we're going to obviously focus on degenerative mitral valve disease. There we go. There's a bit of a delay on this. So it has a number of names, doesn't it? It's always very frustrating that we have one disease that has a ton of different names. So you can talk about degenerative valvular disease, which is one of my favorite, or degenerative mitral valve disease. Chronic acquired valvular disease, you might hear in some of the papers. And then my least favorite is endocardiosis, because it means absolutely nothing as far as I'm concerned. There is no osis of the valves. The endocardium isn't particularly affected by it. It's a misnomer, and it confuses everybody with endocarditis. So I would recommend avoiding that, and you'll see that in most of the veterinary cardiology books, it's mentioned as a synonym, but not really used as the term to describe this. And in human medicine, people get degenerative valvular disease, they don't get endocardiosis. So let's try and avoid using that term. You can certainly use the word myxomatous valvular disease as well, because myxomatous does describe the pathological process that goes on in this disease. So when we think about it, as I've said, it's the most common heart disease that we recognize in our small animal patients, with at least 75% of the heart disease presented to you in general practice. So it is what you see all the time. And as you know, its disease increases with age. Unfortunately, some small breeds get it relatively young, such as our beloved Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. So by the time they're 5 to 6 years old, about half of all Cavaliers would be expected to have a murmur associated with mitral valve disease. And the problem when they get it that young is it gives them time to progress and actually develop the clinical signs later on. So basically all small breed dogs are potentially at risk of this. The Cavalier King Charles Spaniel is outstanding in the frequency, and it's estimated in the United Kingdom that approximately half of all Cavalier King Charles Spaniels will die from congestive heart failure. So it's a major cause of mortality and morbidity among this breed. But it is also common in other breeds. It's common in miniature schnauzers, Maltese, Yorkshire Terriers, and I've discovered in the United States that we have hundreds upon thousands of Chihuahuas who also suffer from this disease. So it's a really common disease in the Chihuahua, which is not great because they're not as easygoing as the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Indeed, Dr. Ichi, who we'll talk about a little later in his surgery, says that the most common breed he operates on is the Chihuahua. But that might represent breed predilections in Japan, obviously. It is more common and more severe, so it occurs a little bit earlier in male dogs, and also it seems to have a more severe progression of the disease, and it's rare in cats as well, in case you're wondering why we don't see it very often in cats. You'll be glad to know that it isn't just a UK problem. We also see it in the United States as frequently with a very similar age incidence, and you'll see this is where we get the 50% incidence at the 5 to 6 year from. Sweden, it does occur, but a little bit later. And in Australia, it's maybe even later. And that probably reflects the fact that most Cavaliers in the United Kingdom have been sent out to the United States and then a bit to Sweden and then to Australia. This is for Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. So just shows how common the disease is in these breeds. And then also, this graph shows for Cavalier King Charles Spaniels again the insurance database information. So you can see that the peak incidence of murmurs, which is the first open bars, occurs at about 6 to 7 years old, or 7 to 8 years old on this graph. Okay, so that's where most of them have murmurs. Ooh. Yeah, so on this graph up here. Later on, the second graph with the filled bars represents the reported deaths of these dogs. So you'll see that the curve actually follows the incidence, but with a delay of about 3 years. So in other words, it takes approximately 3 to 4 years for Cavaliers to go from having a murmur to dying of their heart disease. So as you can see, if they get the murmur at 6 or 7, they die at 10 and 11. So it's a horrible disease for this breed. Yeah, I am concentrating on Cavaliers, and I apologize to Cavaliers lovers among us, but unfortunately this is kind of what we sometimes see. This is a study that we did looking at the Cavalier database, where we went and listened to a bunch of Cavaliers, and in fact we listened to about 10,000 Cavaliers, and so this represents 16,000 examinations. So what it just represents is the likelihood that a Cavalier may be free of a murmur. And you can see that initially most Cavaliers don't have murmurs, but as they get older, obviously the number that have murmurs increases significantly, till by the time they're kind of 13 years old, almost all Cavaliers have got murmurs. There is a difference. The blue line at the top represents dogs represented by the blue line at the top is the dogs examined by GP veterinarians, and the red line at the bottom represents cardiologists. So it's clear that cardiologists do seem to detect the murmurs earlier, which is why we kind of want cardiologists to do these breed screening tests to pick up the murmurs earlier. There is a subtle difference between the dog and the bitch as well, the dogs developing the murmur earlier, as we said previously. For bitches that were examined by GP vets, we actually did manage to document over the time period we looked at a decrease in the an increase in the age instance that they were free of a murmur. So what we saw with time is that by selective breeding of the Cavaliers with the scheme that the Cavalier Club agreed to, we were able to push the age at which the Cavaliers got a murmur from 8.6 years to 9.15 years over the 20 years that this data represents. You may say that's not fantastic to push it by half a year, but when you bear in mind that very few of the Cavalier breeders were actually taking part in this actively, then that, I think, explains the frustration. We didn't see that improvement for dogs or for dogs or bitches examined by cardiologists, but that may be a reflection of just the low numbers in that particular those particular groups. So as we said, it's really a disease most commonly of the mitral valve, which is why it has the name degenerative mitral valve disease. And it seems to be most severe in the mitral valve. The tricuspid valve can also be affected. It's uncommon to have it only in the tricuspid valve. Maybe 1 to 2% of dogs will have it in the tricuspid valve. And sometimes when I'm at a show listening to a dog, I will hear a typical apical murmur of degenerative Adler disease on the right side. And I do wonder if those dogs have mainly right-sided disease. And typically it's not significant unless they start to develop pulmonary hypertension. But kind of all the dogs, about a third, I usually go on about a third of the dogs will have disease of the mitral and tricuspid valve, and about two-thirds will have the mitral valve only, and maybe 1%. I know that adds up to 101%, but maybe 1% will have tricuspid-only disease. And as I say, we sometimes see it in degenerative valve disease of the aortic and pulmonic valves, but it's not really usually significant. What happens in that valve? Well, the valve itself becomes thickened with this spongiosa becoming increased, and that's the proteoglycan. It's a kind of mucopolysaccharide that accumulates in the valvular interstitial cells. In addition, the fibrosa gets degenerated because of disorganization of the collagen, and actually the collagen starts to disappear from these valve leaflets, so they do become weakened. What causes it, we don't know, but undoubtedly we've shown quite clearly in the Cavaliers that it's really strongly inherited. So by breed schemes, we should be able to help get rid of this disease, but it does need the cooperation of the breeders, which has been not easy to come by. The lesions on gross pathology, as you know, you have these nodules at the valve margins, which seem to enlarge and coalesce. The leaflet edges become distorted, they roll over, and as a result they leave the gap that allows the mitral regurgitation. The cordy tendineae are also affected by this disease, and so what you sometimes see is thickening of the cordy tendineae, and they can rupture. And clearly if they rupture, then if the cordy tendineae attaches to the middle of the valve, what we see is a valve prolapse. So the valve kind of pops up into the atria a little bit during systole, giving a kind of seagull wing appearance. But if the cordy tendineae attaches to the tip of the leaflet and that ruptures, then that allows the valve to flail back into the left atrium during systole with a significant increase in the leak. And that's why one of the reasons why this disease is so frustrating to deal with and to predict the progression, because in some dogs they can have caudal rupture of the tip of the leaflet cord and as a result go into heart failure, and other dogs can just gradually have an increase in heart size. So we see a whole spectrum of dogs that have different heart sizes in heart failure, because it depends on the degree of progression of the disease. We know from some of the studies that one of the predictors of when they're going to go into failure is the heart size. We often see a rapid increase in heart size in the last few months before they actually go into failure. So radiographing the dogs is certainly helpful to help document that. And unfortunately, the disease is progressive. And so, as you can see, if they get the disease relatively young, they have time to progress and develop heart failure and ultimately die from the disease. This I've kind of talked about before, in that the mitral valve alone is about maybe two-thirds of dogs. One-third get mitral and tricuspid, and then about 1% get just tricuspid valve disease. But it's not that common to see that, but you see it occasionally. And as you know, initially there is no change. The volume of the mitral regurgitation is small, so there is no structural change, and so we call that the B1, and we are quite relaxed about that. That's okay, the dog's got mitral valve disease, we can hear the classic left apical systolic murmur, but there are no hemodynamic changes, the left atrium is not big, the left ventricle isn't enlarged, and we can be somewhat relaxed. The dogs can go for many years in this stage, so we don't need to worry. However, unfortunately, what happens with time, because the disease progresses, we can see enlargement of the left atrium, that top chamber, and as the left atrium starts to enlarge with the increasing regurgitation, that can cause hemodynamic consequences. The dilated left atrium and left ventricle start to show, start to compress the trachea and the bronchioles, and we can start to see a cough generated with that. And we can pick these changes up very easily with either either echocardiography or with radiography. So, you know, I'm a cardiologist, so I spend a lot of my time doing doing echocardiograms. But I don't think there's anything wrong with taking radiographs to assess these dogs. Once we know it's the disease, it's a left apical systolic murmur, there's not many other things that it's going to be in a small breed dog. And I think you can track this sequentially with radiographs. I don't think you need to wheel out the echo machine or send it to an echocardiologist every few months for an echo. A, because it's relatively slightly progressive, but also because you should do what you can do in your practice. And I think radiographs are a great way of tracking the progression of this disease. So I would encourage you to continue taking radiographs of these, because you can see the changes in the progressions, and that can help guide you when you should start treatment for this disease. I think one of the issues also for these dogs is to get dilation of the mitral annulus. So the little ring of fibrous ring that the mitral valve sits in starts to dilate with dilation of the chambers. And as that annulus dilates, it kind of drags the leaflets further apart. And that causes a significant progression of this disease. So it becomes like a positive feedback loop, that the more it leaks, the bigger that annulus gets and the worse the leak gets. So you can see that positive feedback. And that's probably why we see this rapid progression in heart size up until the point they go into failure. So what can we see as a result of that? So typically, well, we all know they can get congestive heart failure, but we can also see atrial arrhythmias. So we'll sometimes see atrial premature beats, and in some small breed dogs we'll actually document atrial fibrillation, although that is relatively uncommon because, as you know, atrial fibrillation relies on a certain atrial size to maintain itself. And so if you've got a relatively small dog and a small atria, it's unlikely to be big enough to sustain atrial fibrillation. So typically, if I see atrial fibrillation in a dog with mitral valve disease, it's either a larger breed dog or it's a small breed dog with awful disease. We talked about caudal rupture and how that can either cause valve prolapse, or it can allow the leaflet to flail and result in a significant increase in the regurgitation. We can see a left atrial tear, and in the image that I've got there for you at the bottom, this was actually a dog that I started on the Quest study many years ago, and the dog died acutely, and when we did a post-mortem, he had a subendocardial tear, which you can see just above the leaflet, almost all the way through his left atrium, and that clearly caused an arrhythmia, and he dropped dead suddenly. But look at that valve, it's horrible with all its nodular lesions. I think he was a Cavalier. I've talked about the bronchial compression of the main stem bronchus, and that can generate a cough. So I think one of the big issues that we need to be wary of is to diagnose heart failure in dogs who have a murmur and cough. For me, that is not heart failure. For me, the most important way of diagnosing heart failure is radiographs and looking for an increased respiratory rate and effort. In studies, it has been shown that just counting the respiratory rate is more accurate than any single echocardiographic parameter at diagnosing congestive heart failure. So it's certainly a great idea to get your owners of dogs with heart enlargement to start counting the resting respiratory rate, because it is a really good way of letting you know when heart failure occurs. Clearly, this is resting respiratory rate. We don't want to be rung up every 5 minutes because the dog's panting after running around the garden. So you need to train the owners a little bit on how to do this. And then the other kind of thing we sometimes see with mitral regurgitation is pulmonary hypertension. And this is a really difficult disease to diagnose if you're a general practitioner, because we often rely on the tricuspid regurgitation velocity to assess pulmonary artery pressures. So you would need to be able to do an echocardiogram to assess pulmonary hypertension. Typically, we don't see this in the early stages of the disease, but once the dogs have significant amounts of regurgitation, it will start to emerge. Usually it's mild to moderate, but when they have heart failure, it can reach severe stages. And there is benefit in some of these dogs to starting them on a drug to reduce their pulmonary artery pressures. The one we use is sildenafil, known by its trade name as Viagra, maybe familiar to some of you. And we typically give that at kind of 1 to 2 mg per kg, 3 times a day initially. It's pretty expensive, but now it's generic. The price has come down significantly, so it's certainly affordable, and many dogs do better. The trouble with pulmonary hypertension is that there's no single specific clinical sign of it. We sometimes see it in dogs who are lethargic. We'll sometimes see it in dogs who are collapsing. We get dogs referred into our neurology service and their diagnosis is pulmonary hypertension, and we treat them for the pulmonary hypertension with sildenafil, and they're much improved. So it can be a difficult disease to diagnose, but we know that if they have pulmonary hypertension, they tend to do worse than the dogs who don't have pulmonary hypertension. So the dogs with degenerative valve disease have a long asymptomatic period. So we will pick up the murmur at a routine vaccination. We'll pick up the murmur maybe at a kind of wellness exam. And certainly at that point, I think radiographs are useful. But we'll go through a long period where they have no heart enlargement. Then we'll go through a period where they have heart enlargement, moving from the stage B1 to the B2, the heart enlargement stage. But still, clinical signs are minimal. Really, we don't appreciate clinical signs until heart failure develops. Perhaps if we did more stringent exercise tests on these dogs, we'd maybe pick up some deterioration in their exercise. But let's face it, most of the small breed dogs are couch potatoes, so picking up their exercise intolerance is difficult. But once they develop heart failure, then the typical signs develop. And for me, as I say, the most important one is increase in breathing rate and effort, as I say, with or without coughing. If they cough and they've got those, then fine, they've got heart failure. If they don't cough and they've got the tachypnea, dyspnea, orthopnea, they've still got heart failure. And I stress this because there's many vets in the United States and in the UK, I know, will start treatment with a dog who's got a murmur and is coughing. And that may not be appropriate, as we'll talk in a little bit when we come on to treatment. So it's certainly worth, if they're only coughing, ruling out other causes. So I think radiographs are essential for these dogs. And we can certainly see the pulmonary edema quite clearly on the radiographs when that does occur. When heart failure occurs. On our physical exam, we talked about the murmur being typically left apical and systolic, and sometimes it can vary in its loudness. So if the murmur is, if the jet is pointing somewhat eccentrically towards the free wall, and hence the chest of the dog, then that murmur can be relatively loud. But the same volume regurgitation, if it's pointing more dorsally, it may not be as loud. So sometimes the loudness of the murmur is determined by the direction of the jet, and that varies depending on the which valves, leaflets are affected and how they're affected. So I often find that, generally speaking, the loudness of the murmur can help guide you as to how severe the disease is. I think there are other things we can do in our physical examination that can potentially be as helpful or more helpful. I always put my hand on the side of the dog's chest and feel for the apical beat. So if the apical beat is pretty strong, for me that suggests the dog is has more severe disease. So that's due to the volume overload of the in the left side of the heart. We get this really kind of force, almost as if the heart's kind of banging on the side of the chest when they have more advanced disease. I can see I've got a question about radiographs. I'll try and answer that when we get onto the radiograph section, I promise. Let's see. I don't know what happened there. Okay. Okay, so what do we see on radiographs? So maybe I'll address that question now. So there's a question of, would I use radiographs to, where I use general anesthesia to radiograph? No. I guess it depends on the stage of the dog. If I've seen this dog frequently, like every 6 months, and this is the first time I detect a murmur, then it's likely to be early mitral valve disease. So for that dog, if you had to, you could probably anaesthetize it to take the radiographs. However, if it's the first time I've seen the dog and it's a loud murmur, I don't know if that dog has an eccentric jet or it has a massive heart like this one here and is on the point of failure. So I would be reluctant to radiograph. I'm really lucky here. I know I'm spoiled because I work at the University of Florida, and I just book the dog in for radiographs, and they basically tape the dogs to the table to take the radiographs. I'm not sure how they've done it because I've never witnessed it, but they seem to use a lot of tape and actually tape the dogs to the table, and they're not in the room where the radiographs are taken, and that seems to work pretty well. If you wanted to sedate the dogs, you could use a little bit of an opioid would be fine, and certainly that's what I used to use in general practice and in referral practice in the UK. But similarly here, we don't hold dogs for radiographs. If we have to hold them, then we sedate them or give them a general anaesthesia. So I guess, as I say, it depends on how severe I think the disease is likely to be. So when you look at the radiographs, you probably will be fairly familiar with this. So in here we talk about the backpack sign. So it's like the dog has a bedroll stuck on its back. So it's got the big left atrium as a large soft tissue density, somewhat triangular, pointing out the back end of the heart into the caudodorsal lung fields. You'll also see that in this case, the left ventricle is also enlarged, and to me that's is indicated by the elevation of the trachea. So if I see an elevated trachea, for me that's left ventricular enlargement. If I see that triangular density, that's left atrial enlargement. And there are very few diseases where you'll just get enlargement of one chamber. Mitral stenosis potentially could just cause one, but typically it would be both. That's what you should be looking for: elevation of the trachea and that soft tissue density on the lateral views. On the DV views, the left atrium sits roughly in the kind of caudal central area as shown. The left ventricle is rounded on the kind of 3 to 6 o'clock position. The left atrium has the ear-like projection, the left auricle, that extends at the 2 to 3 o'clock position. So you'll often see a bump at the 2 to 3 o'clock position with left atrial enlargement. So look for those on your radiographs, and that suggests you've got an increased heart size. Okay, so we talked about the trachea being elevated, being pushed out from its more ventral position. And similarly, if you imagine where the airway runs on the DV view, you can see that the left mainstem bronchus runs between the left atrium and the left auricle. So you can see that that is underrun by the left atrium, left auricle. And as a result, when that gets bigger, the left bronchus is the one that is preferentially elevated by the enlarging left side of the heart. And so you'll see that on the lateral radiograph as splitting or division of the left mainstem bronchus as it gets pushed up by the left side. So people talk about a cowboy appearance. It's what they do in the United States anyway, where you have these two bronchi coming out at that kind of angle. But to me, it's more of a one-legged cowboy because it's the left one that gets moved more than the right. So somebody just asked about the 2.5 to 3.5 rib spaces rule for the chest, and typically that is kind of what you can use to assess the width of the heart. That certainly works, so we use that. It is variable, so dogs with tall, narrow hearts like Dobermans tend to be in the 2.5 range, whereas your Labrador Retrievers have more rounded, squat-looking hearts. But better than that would be the vertebral heart score. So here, for example, is how we measure it, where we take the long axis from the carina down to the apex of the left side of the heart, and then we measure the width at 90 degrees to that at the widest point. And then we take those two lines and we lie them starting at the beginning of the fourth thoracic vertebrae, and then just count the rib spaces. And in this case, it came up at 11.1. So this is this is slightly increased. Typically, when Buchanan first described the virtual heart score, he worked out a normal at 9.7 plus or minus 0.5. We often go as and use 10.5 as the top end of normal for most breeds, but there is a variation. So there are some breeds where 11 is normal, and unfortunately the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel sits in that group, so up to 11 for Cavaliers is actually normal. So this might actually be normal for a Cavalier. But with the disease progressing, so again, this I think shows the benefit of doing sequential radiographs, that you start off with 11.5, you take the radiographs the next year of the same dog, and lo and behold, it's now gone up to 11.7, so we're seeing enlargement. And you can see that soft tissue. I'm trying to think if I can get this working now. How do I? Okay, sorry. Let me just go back. Sorry. I was trying to use the pointer and I was failing miserably. I don't kind of know how that works. Anyway, so you can see in the 2006, the vertebral heart score has gone up to 11.7. And if you look at the caudal part of that, caudal dorsal part, you can see the triangular soft tissue density of the left atrium now clearly apparent. And then finally in the 2007, you can imagine the trachea being elevated. It looks like it's been squeezed, it looks like it pinches out to a very thin line, it's getting a bit compressed there, and the vertebral heart score in that dog is now 12.2. So we're seeing progressive increase in the heart size of this dog as the disease progresses. And as I say, I'm really happy and comfortable doing that. When dogs develop congestive heart failure, what happens is they typically get the edema in the perihilar dorsochordal region. And so just take that off because that's the green arrow is just irritating me. There we go. Ooh, go away. There we go. So you can see the edema in the dorsochordal region there as a interstitial stroke alveolar pattern. With alveolar, we see air bronchograms. And remember, you can see the bronchus going cranially, usually from the cranial bronchus running forward to the cranial lobes, and above the bronchus is the artery and below it is the vein. And we use the little mnemonic that veins are ventral and central to remember that. So on the lateral view, the pulmonary vein is ventral to the bronchus. On the DV view, the pulmonary vein is central to the bronchus, whereas the artery is peripheral. Again, you can see the edema and on the DV view. In this view, I think you can see it more clearly in the right caudal lobe. You can see they're graying. To me, when I look at that lateral projection, remember we were talking about the backpack sign. Well, for me, when they get pulmonary edema, we always get blurring of that backpack sign. So it's difficult to see the outline of the left atrium clearly because there's fluid around it now, so it's somewhat blurred, so you can't see it as clearly as I think you can hopefully see on this radiograph. And typically when dogs first get pulmonary edema, they get it in the right caudal lobe, so it's very common that the right side looks more severely affected than the left, and that's kind of what we normally see with it. So these are typical signs of pulmonary edema. We talked about airway compression, and if you're lucky enough to have fluoroscopy, you can see that in a moving video. If you don't, you can try and take different x-rays during inspiration and expiration to document it. But typically, it's a coughing dog with advanced mitral valve disease. So you can see how the airway looks open during inspiration, and then during expiration, it just collapses down completely. And you can imagine as the walls hit together, that's a fairly severe irritation to the airways and could generate the cough. Unfortunately, we don't have great treatment options for a cough in mitral valve disease. We could try and reduce the heart size using diuretics and potentially pimobendan, but in many of these dogs, they have a cough that we can't control completely. You know, we often have to educate the owner that it's not a problem the dog is coughing. He will cough occasionally with his disease. We don't have great treatment options that are going to stop that completely, although we can improve it with drugs like Lomotil and hydrocodone. What about ECGs? Well, ECGs in my view is really not very helpful unless there's an arrhythmia. Yes, we can see wide P waves due to left atrial enlargement. We may even see a wide QRS due to the left ventricular enlargement. But if you want to know if there's a big left atrium or left ventricle, you're either going to radiograph or you're going to do an echo. You know, radiographs, an ECG isn't going to be very helpful. This dog also, for those of you who've been looking at it, will have seen the atrial premature complex. It comes in a little bit early. There's no P wave, or the P wave is buried in the previous T wave, and that's quite common to see with this disease because the atria get upset, they're being stretched by the mitral regurgitation, so you will see atrial premature complexes quite frequently with this disease. And as I say, we can document atrial fibrillation as we talked about earlier. So here's some videos for you. If you're not familiar with echocardiography, here's a view of the from the right side of the left ventricle. If we want to play that video, I don't know if we can play it. See if that's running. Hopefully it's running better for you than it is for me. Oh, there we go. Maybe I'll speed up a bit. So the top there, so you've got the left ventricle and left atrium. They're still maybe slightly enlarged, but you can see that the mitral valve looks pretty abnormal. It looks almost shaggy. It's got these thickenings, particularly towards the distal tip of the valve leaflet. You can see that the valve leaflet maybe pops back a little bit into the left atrium during systole. And the leaflet on the right-hand side attached to the septum is the anterior leaflet. And the leaflet attached to the free wall is the posterior leaflet. And typically the anterior leaflet is the bigger leaflet, and it's usually more severely affected by this disease, as we can see. So you can clearly see the thickening of the valve. And if we can put the other video up. So this is a left apical view, similar kind of thing. So here you can actually see maybe better the kind of seagull appearance as the valve leaflet bulges back slightly into the left atrium during systole. But again, we can document the thickened valve leaflet. So we know the dog has this disease quite clearly. So we can assess that. If we can put up the next video. Okay, thank you. So this is a color flow. So immediately you probably see that this heart looks much bigger. Just volume-wise, the left atrium looks huge. It looks like a little football. The left ventricle also looks quite rounded. We put color flow on, which allows us to see the regurgitation, the green jet, going back from the left ventricle into the left atrium during systole. In a dog with advanced disease like this, about half of the output from the left ventricle is just going straight back into the left atrium. So there's a significant backflow into the left atrium there. If we put up the next video, this is the short axis view from the right side, and this is the view we use to assess left atrial size. Yes, we can do it on the long axis as we saw there just in the previous video, but also on this one you can see the middle, that round thing in the middle of the screen is the aorta with its leaflets. You can see the little 3-8 leaflets looking like a Mercedes-Benz sign. And then the big black structure in the bottom left-hand corner, a little kind of round thing with a little tail going up to the right hand side, is the left atrium, and that tail to the right hand side is the left auricle. So typically what we do is we measure the diameter of the aorta and compare it to the diameter of the left atrium running along a line across the aorta diagonally to the bottom left hand corner. So the normal ratio is 1 for the aorta to 1.6 for the left atrium. You can see in this case it's going to be 2.5 probably. So there's a significant left atrial enlargement on this. So this is one of the ways we can assess left atrial enlargement on echo progressively. The other thing on that video as well, sorry, you can just pull that video up for a second again. On that video, if you look at the tail of the video, you will see that there is a small pericardial effusion around the left. So you see that there's like a black line between the left ventricle, the right ventricle in the top right hand corner and the free wall. So you can actually see all the border of the of the left atrium as the pericardial fluid kind of shows it really clearly. And that's probably a sign that this dog may have had failure. Okay, can you just pull up the next video, please? So this is more looking more at the tricuspid valve. So this is again looking from the right side. So the tricuspid valve here is at the top of the screen. You can see the left side further away, left ventricle and left atrium. So the right ventricle is like the triangular structure closest to the screen, and then the tricuspid valve is on the right-hand side of that, with the right atrium just beyond it. And you can see how much that tricuspid valve prolapses back into the right atrium. You can see it's nicely frozen there to show you. So it has that kind of seagull appearance, wing appearance. If you just pull up the next video, we'll just show you that in color so you can see the regurgitation, the green regurgitation. So we measure this velocity to assess pulmonary artery pressures. And if anybody wants more details, then just contact me and I can show you tell you how to do that. So one of the important things we do is we use the staging of heart failure, the new staging system from A to D, because this is really helpful. Why is it helpful? Because we can basically draw a line between B1, and if they're B1 or less, i.e. they have no enlargement, we just don't treat them. There is no indication that treatment at this stage makes any difference. So if they've got a normal heart size, you can relax, see them in a 6 months or a year's time. But once they start to get heart enlargement, then we start to talk about treatment for these dogs. And clearly once we're in failure. So why do we do that? Well, because we have had the EPIC study, which is a big study comparing pimobendan to placebo to see when these dogs actually went into failure. And pimobendan delayed the onset of heart failure. What about ACE inhibitors? Well, there have been two studies, the SVEP study and the VetProof study. Neither of those studies conclusively showed that using ACE inhibitors delayed the onset of failure. I personally don't recommend them with dogs with big hearts. I wait till they go into failure. Some cardiologists in the United States still do recommend them. I think it's personal choice. You can find people to advocate for either side. Do what you want. It doesn't really... we don't think it makes the progression worse, which I think is a good thing. I think I would have a discussion once they have heart enlargement about potentially using some sodium restricting, using I tell owners to avoid high sodium diets and high sodium treats. I don't usually use low sodium diets because particularly the very low sodium diets can actually turn on the renin angiotensin system, so probably best avoided in the early stages. And potentially, if they want to do something, they can supplement with the omega-3 fatty acids. And there is a ratio of the DHA and EPA milligram per kilogram that's been published by Lisa Freeman in the JSAP that you can easily access to find the doses if you need. Once they go into failure, we typically start them on diuretics, pimobendan, if they're not already on pimobendan, ACE inhibitors and aldosterone antagonists that we'll talk about shortly. And then potentially surgery, which we'll end on here. This is the EPIC study data. So all the dogs are not in failure to start with. Then as they go into heart failure, they drop out of the study, and the heart failure was due to was documented by radiographs showing pulmonary edema. So it's a pretty good study. About nearly half of the dogs were Cavaliers. And we delayed the onset of heart failure compared to placebo by nearly 15 months, as you can see from those figures. But interesting enough, I think even early in the study, the graph started to diverge. So we saw a benefit all the way through the study from the beginning to the end, with the pimobendan dogs doing better. And remember, these dogs spent 15 months longer in the study. So there is some talk that dogs die quicker with, you know, they may have more sudden death, but they spent 15 months longer in the study. So it's not surprising we had potentially more side effects and more adverse reactions in the pimobendan group, because they spent, you know, a year and 3 months longer in the study. So I don't believe that there's a problem with arrhythmias in pimobendan in dogs. When we look at the ACE inhibitors, these are the two studies. So on the left-hand side is the SVEP study, enalapril and placebo, and there is no difference between them as to when they go into failure. The second one is the Clark Atkins VetProof study, which some people claim shows benefit, and I really can't see that in the graph, and statistically it didn't show it in the all dogs mortality or heart failure group. So most of us don't recommend ACE inhibitors at this stage. So what was the EPIC criteria? So they had to have a big heart. So In the EPIC criteria, they had to have a virtual heart score in excess of 10.5. I mean, clearly, for some cavaliers, that could be normal. So that's one of the criticisms of the studies. But in this case, I think we know that if the dogs have a vertebral heart score of about 11.3, they would all meet all of the EPIC criteria. So if you were just using radiographs, you might go on 11.3 as your vertebral heart score. They had big hearts on echo as well. That was one of the criteria, based on the diameter of their left ventricle normalized to their weight, and also their LA to AO ratio that I showed you earlier had to be over 1.6. So they all had big hearts, so they had that secondary remodeling. So we know we use pimobendan for the B2s, and then when we go into failure, for me, we use the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So we use a diuretic, typically furosemide, and we start it intravenously when they actually go into failure at relatively high doses and titrate those down. So often they'll be going home when I discharge them at, say, 1 to 2 mg per kg, say, 3 times a day. And I'd get the owners to step it down to from 3 times a day to twice a day, maybe 2 or 3 days after they've gone home. Pimobendan, they stay on that, or they already are on that, or we start that if they're not already on that at kind of 0.2 to 0.3 mg per kg. The ACE inhibitor, we would start at that stage, but I often don't start the ACE inhibitor when they come in an acute heart failure, because I don't think it makes a lot of difference to them clinically. What I think is it stops them or delays their death. And so I often give it to the owner at discharge after we've got them out of heart failure and say, once they're eating normally, that's when I would start them on this drug. And you can pick between enalapril or benazepril, depending on which you want. I don't think it really makes any difference. There's really been no evidence to show that any ACE inhibitor is superior to any other, so long as they're one of the newer generations. I am old enough that I can remember captopril. Nobody uses that anymore, so I won't talk about it. And then finally, spironolactone. Well, spironolactone is, we were all taught at college that it was a diuretic, and it really isn't a diuretic, because you can give spironolactone till the cows come home and the dogs will never drink any more or pass any more urine. What it is an aldosterone antagonist. So it blocks one of the harmful hormones that gets upregulated in heart failure. We know angiotensin 2 gets upregulated, which is why we use ACE inhibitors. Also, as a consequence of that, aldosterone, I've been in the States too long, gets increased. And we use spironolactone to block that. Why do we do that? Because aldosterone is harmful to the heart. It causes myocardial fibrosis. It causes myocardial cell death. And in the studies that have been carried out in people and one study in dogs, it seems to slow the progression of their heart failure significantly. So I think I don't. For me, it's a long game I play with these dogs. I want them to live as long as possible, and so I start them on spironolactone. I add it in, telling the owners that clinically the dogs are not going to, they're not going to see any difference clinically, but I think the dogs live longer. I live in the United States, so spironolactone for me is a really cheap drug because we can use generics, human generics, and I know that may not be the case in the UK, but maybe it will be after Brexit. Who knows? Let's not get talking about Brexit. Anyway, so medical treatment of congestive heart failure is, as we've said, the big four. Sometimes I also check their blood pressure, and I'll do that sometimes when they come in acute failure, because using vasodilators to decrease their blood pressure can increase the output from the heart and reduce the amount that regurgitates, the regurgitant fraction. So just if they come in with a blood pressure of like 150, 160, then lowering that to 100 to 120 when they're in acute failure can be really beneficial to those dogs. And similarly, if they're hypertensive when they go home or they have high normals, then I would probably think about starting them on amlodipine, which is my drug of choice to lower their blood pressure to improve the output. What about interventions for these patients and surgery, which we kind of touched on? Michaela Borgarelli at Virginia Tech has been using these harpoon device, which is a device where it replaces the cords by actually putting them through the apex. So you have like a big catheter you stick in the apex of the heart and through the valve, and then fire a trigger and it ties a knot the other side of the valve and then pulls the suture tight down onto the left ventricle free wall. And he's had some success in experimental cases, although I think the clinical case that he recently did didn't go so well. So maybe that's one option. And there's another device called a NeoCord, which we hope to be playing with if I can persuade the company to let us play with it. I think for our dogs, it's really variable. Owners always ask, so how long has he got? Well, some dogs never show progression. We continue to monitor them. And as a result, if they get it at like 11, 12, B1, they may never go on and develop the disease. But because of caudal rupture, we'll often see acute exacerbation. So it's very difficult to predict. So if I see 10 dogs with the disease, I can tell you roughly how long they half of them will take to go into failure. So for dogs in the EPIC study, the B2 dogs actually, and they had pretty big hearts, took on average 3.5 years, nearly 3.4 years, to go into failure. So that's quite a long time. So if you're 11 and you're in B1, B2, you may never die of your heart disease. But if you're a Cavalier and you're 6-7 years old, you can die at 9 from this. And once they develop congestive heart failure, unfortunately, the prognosis is pretty poor. 9 to 12 months, I would reckon, on average for those dogs, even with the best treatment. Although when you look back at the studies like the Quest studies, about 15% of the dogs were still alive at 3 years. So again, there is variable progression. Larger breed dogs do get this disease, and they seem to have a poorer prognosis. They seem to accelerate more quickly with this disease. So what do we do when the drugs don't work anymore if we're trying to manage these medically? So we could try to optimize the drug doses. Typically, we would give pimobendan. Remember, pimobendan probably should be given on an empty stomach. There's some evidence that it is absorbed better, although that's somewhat equivocal. If you look at the studies, some of the studies have said pimobendan should be given on an empty stomach, and some of them say it can be given with food. So the company are not very helpful to try and find out the answer to that. Let me just get rid of that. But make sure the dose is in the higher end of the dose range. The main side effect with pimobendan usually is GI upsets. But if they've already been having it at about 0.1 to 0.15, increase that to 2.5 to 0.3 and try and give it 3 times daily as well. I have to say we have no evidence in terms of actually published data, but we've used it in our clinic, and I think we have some dogs who do improve when they have it more frequently. And similarly with furosemide, don't just increase the dose twice daily. Give it more frequently, because furosemide is relatively short-acting, and so it was called Lasix because it lasts for 6 hours. So if you're giving it twice daily, that's 6 hours where the dog is having no diuretic effect. So give it 3 or 4 times daily. And then if that still isn't enough to keep edema under control, then consider adding in a thiazide diuretic, such as hydrochlorothiazide. And I typically add that once a day and then titrate up from there, because I often see a lot of electrolyte disturbances or dehydration if I use thiazide at high doses. Or you can consider switching to the drug that you have available, torsemide. You lucky people have that available as a prescription. We are forced to use the much cheaper human generic over here. Why do I like torsemide? And we've had some good results in dogs who have advanced disease. I'm not sure. We still tend to use furosemide as our first line. But as soon as we're starting to have to escalate the dose of furosemide, we switch them to torsemide. It has a much longer half-life. It seems to cause less potassium loss as well, which is good in terms of the arrhythmias. And for us, we've seen some dogs go on really, for a long period of time, we've seen some reduction in heart size. So it's certainly been a drug that I've been very impressed with, and we're using more and more of. So what about mitral valve surgery? I kind of mentioned that briefly. So here is the Jasmine Clinic. This is them doing mitral valve repair, and this is an option for dogs now. So if you have a dog, an owner who's relatively wealthy, they can consider flying to Japan to get Dr. Uichi to do the repair process. It will cost them $17,000. You can do the math to work out how much that is in pounds, but they have to fly to Japan and spend 3 weeks in Tokyo while he does it and your dog recovers. Alternatively, you could speak to Dr. Dan Brockman down at the RVC. He also is doing this procedure relatively successfully. I'm not sure how much he charges. It may be in the region of £12,000 to £15,000. I could be wrong. There are wait lists for these. So, and they're operating, both of these teams are operating dogs in the stage B, 2, and C categories. with good success. So Dr. Ichii's published data suggests that over 90% now, he's doing 200 dogs a year, and 94% of the dogs last year survived the surgery. And you say, well, survived the surgery, so what happened long term? Which I'll show you in a second. So clearly the surgery involves putting them on bypass. So you've got to put them on bypass with a bypass machine, which sucks the blood from the venous side. It warms it, it oxygenates it, and then it pumps it back in pressure into the arterial line, which is what the bypass machine does. And he replaces the cord, so he actually repairs the broken cord and stretched cordy tendine with PTFE Gore-Tex sutures down to the papillary muscle. He's changed the way he does that. In fact, I think he does this kind of technique now. And then he also puts he doesn't use a PTFE ring. He actually just uses a suture to kind of pull that mitral annulus together. We talked about the mitral annular dilation. This is how he actually reduces that during surgery. So it's a two-part procedure for the surgery. And then having done all that, he recovers them off bypass. How do they do long term? Well, here are the curves. The blue curve is medical treatment taken from the Quest study. So you can see that the dogs die steadily with a median survival of about 9 months. Half of them were dead by 9 months with medical treatment. Whereas Dr. Ichii, in this particular study, 84%, 87% at this point, survived the surgery. And then they went and died from something else other than heart disease. It depends. I think if they have more severe disease, this isn't a cure. It kind of stops the disease progressing. So we do see some dogs need to stay on medication. But many of the dogs can come off their cardiac medications and die. And most of them die from something else. So it is a very successful procedure for these dogs. I think we covered that, really. Don't know why that's occurred then. Okay, so certainly mitral valve disease is a disease that is very shows variable progression. We start treatment when they have stage B2, meeting the EPIC criteria. If you start a bit earlier than that, if you don't have all the facilities to be able to assess the EPIC criteria, do you do them harm? Probably not. So if you only have radiographs, you could go on a big heart on radiographs. I don't think that's necessarily wrong. When they go into heart failure, document that with radiographs if you can. But remember, look for the increased heart breathing rate and effort. And then treat them with initially furosemide. Then we add in, when they come in acutely, we use furosemide and pimobendan, and then discharge them with an ACE inhibitor. And then usually at the first revisit, I usually see them after a week to check their electrolytes and take radiographs. And at that point, I'll add in spironolactone. So that's the big four that they stay on. And then if their blood pressure is high, we may use amlodipine to reduce their blood pressure. And then follow them gradually with repeat visits. We tend to spread them out. So we start off with a week revisit after the initial episode of heart failure. Then we'll increase that to a month, and then see them every 3 months on an ongoing basis. We radiograph them if we think they've got pulmonary hypertension or other changes are developing, just to document them. But we don't echo them every time they come in. I don't think that's very helpful in terms of changing my treatment. We use the argument that we only really do a procedure if it's going to change our treatment or change the prognosis for the dogs. Otherwise, there's really little point in doing it just because we like the pictures and it's a fun thing to do. And then the congestive heart failure, once they do develop congestive heart failure, unfortunately, the median survival is 9 to 12 months. So maybe at that point, think about surgery and discussing it with owners who can afford it. I know it's not for everybody, but it is a potential thing you should potentially be talking about your owners with. This is one of the lovely things about Florida is we have these freshwater springs that give clear rivers in the spring. So we have lots of these cedar keys that grow, and you can kayak down them. And even at this time of year, the water is at 72 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry, we're talking Fahrenheit over here, not centigrade. So it's pretty warm. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions. I can't see any typed in there. So if there are any, please let me know. I can't read all of the questions for some reason. So I can see if we, thank you. So if we see a small breed dog with a murmur show, how do I see the rest of that question? If we see a small breed dog with a murmur, should we be offering x-ray? I think so, absolutely. I think it's a good way of assessing the dog. Yes, if you've seen that dog frequently and it's the first time that it's got a murmur, it's likely to be stage B1. But that's great because it gives you a baseline as to what the heart actually looks like. So when you take sequential radiographs, if the murmur gets louder, then you can take another x-ray. If the heart looks bigger on radiographs, then you have a discussion about progression and whether you should start on pimobendan. So absolutely, I would strongly recommend that you take radiographs with these dogs when you get a murmur. and just under light sedation, yeah. So I reckon that with most of our dogs in Florida, we relatively, I would say that probably about 5 to 10% of the time we need to sedate the dogs. As I say, our teams seem to be very good at taping the dogs down. They do use a lot of tape, apparently. I haven't witnessed this myself, but the dogs seem to be pretty good. And certainly when I was in the UK, we used to use sandbags and ties to keep the dogs in lateral. Certainly the lateral was pretty easy to get. And DV, sometimes it's a little bit twisted. If you need to sedate them, usually a little bit of butorphanol is fine. Butorphanol plus or minus a little bit of an ACE inhibitor, ACE promazine would be fine. ACP, sorry. Yeah, So that's the kind of sedation combination that I often use in these dogs to get them to lie still for the radiographs. And sometimes you've just got a lateral, and if what you're going on is your vertebral heart score, then that's probably fine, because you can get that from your lateral. Okay, do we have any other questions that you need me to answer? We are actually setting up an open heart program here at the University of Florida, so we're actually flying in Dr. Uichi's team. He'll be coming every 2 months, and we'll be taking chest radio. We'll be hopefully offering that procedure, but unfortunately, we're going to be significantly more expensive than the RVC and Japan. So, if cost is an issue, then go to Japan. I know it's a long way from. For you guys, but it's certainly something
on behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like
to think about and discuss with your owners. Okay. Good. Any more questions? All right. Thank you very much then.